Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Today, here for the Ian Lawyers podcast is Ian Lawyer Kurt Nachman. Jeremy Eldridge is off today. He's kicking his feet up somewhere, enjoying a cold drink. And in his stead, we've got Baltimore Justice Lawyer Roya Hanna. Say hi, Roya.
Hi, Kurt. How are you? How's the podcast world?
It's okay. Occasionally we get call-ins. And for anybody that wants to call in, frequent caller Brian Farisee, if you're out there, you can dial in at 657-383-0809. Today we had a couple of things we wanted to talk about. The first thing was Freddie Gray and sort of the goings-on with the Freddie Gray case and the machinations of State's Attorney Mosby. Also, you know, if you've got a warrant, what do you do to fix it? And how do you sort of what's the process you can go through to get a warrant lifted? And one of the questions I had for you, Roya, is how does the number of overnights affect what a person would pay in child custody? Because that's a question I've gotten from clients. I don't practice family law, but you do a ton of family law work. That was one of the questions we were going to address. And, of course, it continues to be an issue on the news, how you should act on a traffic stop to best preserve your rights as a criminal defendant if you're pulled over for any particular reason. So, Roya, why don't we just start off? You were a prosecutor for how long in the Baltimore City State Attorney's Office?
For 12 years.
And you recently left, and now you're doing some criminal defense, but you're focusing a lot on family law and some immigration stuff. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. So how's it going?
So far, so good. You know, it's a different world from murders to divorce, but, you know, a lot of the issues are the same. And a lot of the hostility is the same, too. So that's pretty common.
Well, and that's one of the funny things you and I had discussions offline about how criminal defense attorneys and prosecutors are actually nicer to each other than civil lawyers are, even though they're supposed to be civil. It's sort of oftentimes exactly opposite that, right?
Right. When lawyers are getting paid by the hour, lawyers can generate a lot of expenses to justify their fee, and a lot of extra work and hostility goes into making those numbers go up and up and up.
So what, starting off with child custody, so what exactly does it mean that you have a certain number of overnights, and how does that affect what you'd have to pay in terms of child custody? I know my clients have told me 120 overnights or 180 overnights. What does that mean? And how does that affect what they would have to pay?
Well, courts look for what they call shared physical custody. And shared physical custody is anything over 35% of the time, which ends up being 128 nights. And once you get to that number, the magic number of 128, the child support is calculated based on the time that the child spends with each parent. Now, obviously, there are other factors that go into it. Child support is also calculated based on the difference in income between those parents. But once you get to that one number, it basically gets cut in a third. So if your child support prior to getting to 128 nights was $1,000 a month, it'll go down to like $700 and then go down even further depending on the income of the other person.
Okay. So for example, you hate to say that strategically, but there would be a monetary savings for caring for your own children for a certain percentage of the time.
Right, because if you're already caring for your child for every other weekend, which generally works out to about 56 nights, and then you have them for the entire summer, so maybe you are already spending 115 days with your child, adding that extra 2 weeks would make a big deal in as far as overall savings as what you're paying per month.
Okay, cool. Well, that's some good information for people to know. And obviously, if you have a divorce issue or a child custody issue or a family law issue, Roya would be the person to call. Her website is linked on the profile page for this podcast, and you can reach her there. But you're mostly in the news recently for an op-ed that you wrote in the Baltimore Sun the other day criticizing current State's Attorney Mosby for, well, what did you criticize her for? Let me just ask that.
Mainly I criticized Ms. Mosby for her management of the office and what she has done to the Office of the State's Attorney for Baltimore City. You know, since she came into the office has lost just a ton of people. In my original op-ed, I said it was approximately 16, but since then, other prosecutors have reminded me that it is much, much more than that. And instead of replacing these people promptly and making sure that the cases were covered properly, Ms. Mosby chose to add a photographer and somebody who tweets and operates their social media accounts and hasn't really been focused on the work of the of prosecution. And because of that, because they have been so short-staffed, the prosecutors have been forced to give cases away and plea them out to things that would have just not been offered a year or so ago.
And, well, also, and of course, if it's your client, that's a wonderful thing.
Exactly.
But I think, you know, we're all humans and you know, we want our what's best for our clients, but, you know, we all have to live in Baltimore and we all have to live in society as a whole, and so we certainly don't want, you know, utter chaos and lawlessness to prevail. Now, are they some states, the last three states' attorneys have pretty much had it a priority where you're not coming off the mandatory on gun cases. Is that what you have observed? Because, frankly, I'm not in Baltimore City Circuit Court very often, so I don't really deal with the violent felonies. Jeremy Eldridge, who's not here with us right now, handles that. Is that what's going on? I mean, are they coming off the mandatories on gun cases?
From what I'm saying, they're coming off the mandatories on gun cases. And, you know, the people who live here, well, you know, they want to exercise their constitutional rights, and they absolutely should, and everyone in this office is here to help them do so. They don't want their moms to be knocked out in the street and, you know, assaulted with a pistol. So that it is an important issue even for everyone in the city.
Right. So, What else happened with this homicide review panel? I read something about that in your op-ed.
So when I was in the state attorney's office, they had started this commission to kind of see what people could do to prevent homicides in the city. And Ms. Mosby, because I think she was concerned about her numbers coming out and concerned about looking bad in the press, decided that she wasn't going to participate in this program. And she gave some reasons which just don't make a lot of sense considering some of her policies and some of the other things that her office has done recently. So I think, you know, she just was concerned about participating because she didn't want the statistics about her office.
So the concerns that were raised regarding witness safety, was that a valid concern? And you actually had firsthand knowledge of this because you went and saw the system in place in Milwaukee, right?
Right. So in Milwaukee, what they would do is all the law enforcement people down to the patrol officer would gather in a room and they'd share every information that they knew about the people who were involved in the particular homicide just to see if there was overlap, to see if they can say, okay, this group is feuding with this group. But that really wasn't the important part. The important part was what the agencies could have done to prevent the homicide. And they didn't share that information, the witness information, with anybody outside of law enforcement and the people who are immediately involved in the commission.
So, no, it
right.
was not a valid concern.
It was not a valid concern, especially when she's up there talking about putting names of witnesses in her press releases and revealing the location of a safe house.
Yeah, I mean, a safe house is a safe house for a reason. I mean, that's like revealing, you know, classified information or, I mean, that's obviously that's what gets people killed. So apparently I must have clicked the wrong button. And we have only a 15-minute podcast today instead of a 30-minute. If we get linked off, I'll try to dial back in, but because we didn't really get to touch on any sort of pending Freddie Gray matters. But so what advice would you have? Because you were a homicide prosecutor. You did gun cases for 5 or 6 years?
5 years.
For a long time. So you handled a lot of car stops, tons and tons and tons of car stops because you get a lot of guns from car stops.
Right.
How should someone act in order to best preserve their rights on a traffic stop, in your opinion?
Well, I think the best thing is to be assertive with the officer, but not to be rude to the officer. And in order to preserve your rights, first and foremost, don't give consent to search. When the officer asks you to step out of the car, you have to comply with that, or because it is an officer safety issue, and they can force you to get out of the car. But if they then follow up with, "And can I search your vehicle?" the answer is no. Make sure that as the officer approaches the vehicle, you reach over and grab your registration, but don't look like you're reaching underneath the seat to grab anything. Don't look like you're trying to conceal something, because if they see you trying to do that, then that may give them probable cause to look there.
Yeah, so I tell clients all the time to not get anything out of their pockets or out of their glove box until the officer is up next to the window, because one of the common ways that officers can articulate getting into the car is what they call furtive movements. In other words, reaching under the seat or reaching down or reaching over, when the reality of the situation is that the person's probably just reaching in their glove box to get there, because everybody keeps their stuff in their glove box, right? But if you wait until the officer's next to your car, he can't say that you were making furtive movements because you were just simply trying to get your license, registration, and insurance information from the car. The other thing I recommend to everybody is to record it. Record the stop.
Right.
Your Court of Appeals has very clearly said that there's absolutely allowed to record the stop. It can't interfere with what the officer's doing. So, you know, my recommendation is, you know, turn that camera on, turn that mic on, set your camera down. You know, as long as your mic is picking up what's going on, and you're calmly and assertively saying, you know, "No, I don't provide you consent to search my car." You know, and obviously, if you're in that situation, you know, our phones forward to our cell phones on the nights, on the weekends. You can always get a hold of us. And we're about to lose you. I just got the 10-second warning from the British lady on the podcast hotline. So I guess we'll wrap it up, and we'll talk to you next week. Thanks.
Bye.